Right. So, like I said, I'm going to speak about Acharimot, but not really. Just enough of an excuse to talk about something else which I enjoy talking about, and which I discovered new things this year that I didn't know before, so I'd like to share them with you. I'll start with Rambam, or not Rambam, with Ani Ma'amin. Right? Ani Ma'amin, the 13 principles of faith. The 13 principles of faith were written by Rambam, and we'll see them at the end. Ani Ma'amin was not written by Rambam. Somebody anonymously took Rambam's 13 principles and stuck them into what we call Ani Ma'amin. If you're all Ashkenazi, you'll all have the same version. If you're Sephardi, there's a different version of Ani Ma'amin. Somebody else anonymously...
Two different people. Does that mean this anonymous person did two versions, or there are two anonymous people?
I guess it's two anonymous people. I don't really know since you're anonymous. It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
But I imagine one's an Ashkenazi anonymous person and one's a Sephardi anonymous person.
You both just have the same idea.
I guess so.
Right.
I don't really know. Also, another anonymous person, although possibly it was Emmanuel from Rome, took the 13 principles and made them into Yigdal, which is a poem, which is very nice, but it has 13 lines, which makes it very difficult to sing, because you've got nothing fits in, so you've got to repeat something somewhere to make it fit. But the reason it's 13 is because of Rambam's 13 principles. But there are significant differences between what Rambam wrote and what the Ani Ma'amin says, and that's topic for a different shiur, which I'm not going to talk about now. So don't trust them. But just by way of introduction to refresh your memories, there is a third of the Ani Ma'amin says, Ani Ma'amin be'emun shlema, she'borei barach shemo eino guf. I believe with perfect faith that God is not physical, has no body. V'lo yisiguhu mesigei haguf, and nothing physical can happen to him. V'ein lo shum dimyon klal, and there's nothing, no image, there's nothing that we can compare him to at all. That's a very important principle for Rambam. Now we're going to forget all about that and go to Parashat Acharimot and then come back. So the beginning of Acharimot deals with the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, and he goes into the Holy of Holies and he does all sorts of different things with animals and blood and what have you, but he also offers the incense in the Holy of Holies, and as the verses say, right, and I've just picked the three incense verses from the beginning of the Parsha. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Daber al Aron Achicha, Vayivo Chalei Al Kodesh. God spoke to Moshe saying, speak to Aaron your brother and tell him not to go into the Holy of Holies at any time. Mibet ha-parochet, inside the curtain. El tmei ha-kaporet, asher ha-aron, before the kaporet, the cover of the ark, which is on the aron. Velo yamut, so that he doesn't die. Ki be'anan er al ha-kaporet, because only in a cloud of incense will I appear on the above the ark, on the kaporet. And the instructions continue. Ve'natan et ha-ketoret al ha'esh lifnei Hashem. And you'll put the ketoret, the incense, on the fire before God. And the cloud of incense will cover the kaporet, which is on the testimony, on the ark, and he won't die. And no man may be in the tabernacle, in the Ol Moed, when he comes to atone in the Holy of Holies until he leaves. He will atone for himself and his family and all of Kal Yisrael. So, if you've learned the Mishnah of Yuma, or if you've ever gone to Shul in Yom Kippur, you'll know that the Kohen Gadol used to go in with a shovel full of incense and a shovel full of coal. He'd go into the Holy of Holies, and when he got into the Holy of Holies, he would then put the incense onto the coals and make the cloud go up. This was a topic of much Machlokas with the Stukim, with the Sadducees. We don't have very many, I think we spoke about this a little bit once, there are not very many arguments that we know of between the Sadducees and the rabbis. Common parlance has it that the Sadducees do not believe in the Torah Shebaal Peh, which is true, but we don't know exactly what they did and did not believe in. So there are three or four different arguments that we know of from the Gemara between the Sadducees and the rabbis. One of them is whether to first put the incense on the coal and then go into the Holy of Holies, or to go into the Holy of Holies and then put the incense onto the coal. The verse is ambiguous. the Sdukim understood that first you put the incense on the coals to make a cloud of incense, and then you go into the Holy of Holies. The rabbis said first you go into the Holy of Holies, and then you put the incense on the coals.
And you come out and
go. No, you carry it in with you.
Oh,
nice. Carry it in, and in, when you're inside.
When you stack it outside, or when you set it in? Yeah.
You have incense and you have coals. When do you mix them together?
Right.
Well, either just before you go in, or after you've got it.
Okay.
I know, it sounds almost trivial, but...
Wait, so what's the point in it? Is it to stop people from seeing what goes on in there? Like, does it make
sense? No, it's part of the routine.
It's what God says you've got to do.
So there's no reason behind it, I shouldn't look for logic.
Well, the logic is if you do it wrong, you'll die. Not you, obviously, but the Kohen Gadol. I'm not sure. The whole of Yom Kippur is... I mean, there's a lot of symbolism in everything, and you can make all sorts of explanations after the fact, but I don't think, even if you read these verses, I don't think you'd necessarily come to a conclusion if it were not for the Torah Shabbal Peh, that this is the way we do it, not differently. But there's a lot at stake here, because if it's done wrong, that's why there were so many, in the Second Temple period, there were more than 300 Kohanim Gedolim, in 420 years, there were more than 300, and the first 40 years of Shimon HaTzadik, the next 80 years of Yochanan and Kohen Gadol. So in the remaining 300 years, there are more than 300 Kohen Gadols, because they all used to go, well...
If they're wrong and die.
They do it wrong and die.
Every year?
Yeah. I don't know if they did it... Well, we'll see, actually, that they didn't always do it wrong, but they all died. Anyway, That's why they tied a rope around them, so they could pull him out afterwards if he died on the... So there's bells on the bottom, right. You could hear when he stopped moving. You just pull him out. Because theoretically, the best man would get the job.
Okay.
In the Second Temple period.
The Second Temple period
was very easy. They just bribed the king, and whoever paid the biggest bribe got the job. Or usually his relative got the job because he didn't want the job himself. Because being Kohen Gadol is quite an important.
Right.
Quite an important gig.
Yeah,
but you get advice. You give it to your relative you don't like very much, and he becomes Kohen Gadol.
And you get all those two bells.
Yeah. So I don't know if they're all Sdukim, but they were all not worthy of the job. But we're going to see, actually, about the first time that Sdukim actually did it their way.
And then they will come up, Kohanim Gadolim.
Who were Sdukim?
Oh, right. Okay.
It seems that there were many Kohanim Gadolim who were Sdukim.
How did they function? How did Bnei Yisrael function with that? I don't understand.
Or was it constant change?
It was constant change, but with someone who only half knows what they're talking about.
Not even half, because they'd teach him. They gave him a week for Yom Kippur to teach him how to do all the sacrifices and show him which way up the animals went and everything.
They must have been completely broken. No.
I mean, they stopped tying the... In the time of Shimon HaTzadik, they used to tie the red thread. They had one red thread tied to the seer Lazarus.
Right.
And the other red thread they used to hang up where everyone could see it. And when all the sins were forgiven, the red thread would turn white. But after Shimon HaTzadik died, it stopped turning white. So they just hid it away from where nobody could see it, so that people wouldn't realize that the whole thing was not working properly.
Wow. I didn't realize it was
so corrupt.
Crazy, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Mishnah at the very beginning of Yuma, it's clear. Just from the Mishnah.
It's bad, but I didn't realize it was so bad for so long. I thought it was more towards the end.
It got worse.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes, it was not great.
How did they function? I don't understand.
I think that the people got the leaders they deserved. Although that's not listed as one of the reasons it was destroyed.
What's the
corruption, bribery, sins. Sinat chinam is the reason, and lashon hara. That doesn't say anything about the fact that everyone was bribing everybody else. And, so I'm going to quote from the Yerushalmi. There are very similar stories in the Bavli, but there's a punchline I want that's only in the Yerushalmi, so you just have to bear with me here if you're not familiar with the Yerushalmi. The Mishnah is the same in both. Right, so the Mishnah in Yuma starts off with they separated the Kohen Gadol from his family for a week beforehand, and they taught him how to do the sacrifice, and they showed him every day what he had to do, and he practiced, and he learned the halachas, and they kept him up all night. But they even say over there were some who couldn't speak. Sometimes the Kohen Gadol could not speak Hebrew. They had to read him books in Aramaic, so he knew what was going on. Anyway, now it gets to Erev Yom Kippur. So the Beis Din have been teaching him for a week. Now hand him over to the Kohanim to do what he has to. So it says in source number 3, Masru Ziknei Beis Din, Ziknei Kehuna. The elders of the Beit Din, who had been teaching him for the past week, handed him over to the elders of the Kehuna. Halichu la'aliyah Beit Avtinas, and they took him to a place called Beit Avtinas, which actually the Gemara says it was not his real name. I've forgotten the real name, but it was called Avtinas because it was like a revolving door, and then you people would just come in and go out, and next year they wouldn't be around anymore. So they renamed it Avtinas. Hishbi'uhu finisteru v'alchulem. The elders of the Beit Din made the Kohen Gadol swear, and then they left him alone. Amrulov, they said to him, Ishi Kohen Gadol, my master, the Kohen Gadol, Anu Shluchei Beit Din, we are the representatives of the Beit Din, Vat Shluchenu V'Shliach Beit Din, and you are our Shliach and the Shliach of the Beit Din. Mashbin Anu Alecha, B'mi Shishichen Eshamo, B'Bait HaZeh, we make you swear by the one who rests his presence in this house, in this temple, that you don't do anything different, don't change anything from how we've told you to do it. And they all went off crying because he was crying because they questioned his integrity. They suspected him of something that he wasn't, and they cried because they suspected somebody who was really a good person. They're all crying and very sad. But they also, why do they have to? What's the big deal? Why do they have to make him take an oath? The English is on the other side of the page, but the Hebrew is here. Lama mashbin oto. Why did they make him take an oath? Mipnei ha-baitusim. Because of the baitusim. Now, I'll be honest, I don't know what the difference is between baitusim and stukim. Baitus and Tzadok were both students of Antigonus Ishtokho. They both went off and did their own thing. It seems, in this context, because the same story elsewhere says stukim, it seems that they used interchangeably. Presumably there were differences between them, but I don't know what they are. But because of the baitusim, bracket, stukim, Sadducees, Shayu Omrim, Yaktir Mibuchut, Viachnis Mibufnim. They learned the verses that you had to first put the incense on the fire, on the coals, and then carry it in afterwards. You first, right, which is the wrong way around. Maisa Be'echad. Once upon a time, there was one Kohen Gadol, who was a Sadducee, Shiktir Mibuchut, Viachnis Mibufnim, who put the incense on the fire before he went in, and then he went into the Holy Place. Now remember, the Torah says if you do it wrong, you're going to die. So you've got to be fairly sure of yourself. I mean, I guess if everyone's dying anyway, what you've got to lose, but you've got to be fairly sure of yourself.
So do you say there have been people that witnessed the Kohen Gadol putting the incense on before it began? Then they knew, and they died, and right. They knew that the next one shouldn't do.
But it could be dying for another
one. Well, he was the first one to do it.
Oh, okay.
But they must have known, and no one witnessed anything because there was no one there.
But why did the first guy make the mistake?
What do you mean? They didn't make them. They said the rabbis are making it all up and have changed the Torah. We've got our Torah and the rabbis are making all these new
but
rules.
But if it worked in the past, why do they think that they can suddenly change it? I don't get it.
They would say
but
that.
Why did you take the risk of that? If everyone's been doing it one way,
right.
And they've been staying alive, or not, but being alive, you're going to decide that, oh, I'm going to do it another way and die. Like, yeah. Why
I'm convinced that my way is right. I don't care if it kills me because I'm sure I'm right.
But I can't even imagine, like, there's no sort of, like, obnoxion or, like, no sort of confidence that can justify that.
This
is
my chance to make a point. I'm sure I'm right. I'm sure I won't die because I'm sure I'm right.
Why? I don't understand. You're not right.
Well, like, you know that. It was hindsight. Now you know that.
Yes, no, but I have hindsight of, like, thousands of years later. They have hindsight of a year. Like, surely they've got better hindsight than I have.
Maybe the guy...
They only have to look a year ago.
He died as well.
They do. He's like, I did it one way. Why am I going to
do it? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
You do it wrong. Do
well,
wrong.
Wait till you and his father says.
Oh,
no,
I don't...
Okay.
It's, like, stupid, right?
I mean, there are people who are convinced they're right. Even if it's going to kill them.
We have a lot of opinions about people that think they're right, and we think they're not right. In this day age. Even more so than
better. Anyway, so okay. So he went and he did it the wrong, the dookie way. Ukshayasa, when he came out, Amar la'aviv, he came home all proud to his dad, and he said, Look at me. Afapi Shaitim Doshim Koyimechem La Asitim. You used to always say this is the correct way to do it, the way I did it, but you never ever did it. Adshe Amad Oto Ish Va'asa. Until I came along, to work up in the third person because he's so important, I came along and I did it. Right, so aren't you proud of me, Dad? Amalot Dad says, oh boy. Afapi Shaitim Doshim Koyimeno. Even though we've been saying it like this, we've always said this is the way to do it. So always, this is the way we learn it. However, we used to do it the way the rabbis told us to do it, how can you say it's right? And it doesn't make sense that way either, but anyway. We knew not to mess with actually doing it the other way. Says his dad, I don't think you're going to live very long, mate. I'll be surprised if you're still around much longer. Amru lo bo yamim kalim ad shemet. And it didn't take long till he died. Some say that his nose fell off and worms came crawling out, because the nose is the first thing to go into the Holy of Holies when you walk, especially if you're Jewish. And kemin parsat egel out betoch metzcha, and there was a hoof print of a calf's foot, of a calf's hoof, on his forehead. Because now it seems that the Yeshamim is a different story. One version of the story is he came out and told his dad what he did and then he died. The other version of the story is he dropped in on the spot with worms crawling out and a hoof print on his forehead. Why a hoof print? The Gemara explained that angels only have one foot,
right,
and it's got a hoof on the end of it. So an angel came and kicked him in the head and killed him.
Pardon? Sorry, that's why we should practice on
Thursday. If you only got one foot, it must have had the kick.
Why didn't Hashem just do it any other way? That's
the whole thing. I don't know. I know why the worms came out of his nose. Because it was a
first.
Yes, the face is melted.
Yeah. When he died on the spot, as he entered.
It's got all bells going ding, 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 ding.
And then they pulled him out. And the eye was drawn off.
Yes. There's a whole discussion because there was another stuk you tried to do something different on Sukkot with the water, and he died because he went through the etrog venom and killed him. And we can't remember, is it the same one or a different one? Anyway.
The ones that died, he died a different way, or was it the top
that
he died? No, that's what I'm asking. Why did he be an angel?
I don't know.
How did the
others die? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't know. Okay. Anyway, the question is now, and we're kind of finishing the Yom Kippur a little bit. Ba'un Komi Rabbi Abahu. The students asked Rabbi Abahu, and I really want to talk about Rabbi Abahu tonight. That's the main topic. The Haktiv, does it not say the Kol Adam Le'ev Omed Bevor Lechaber Kodesh Ad Seito? It says, as we read in the third verse in source number 2, no Adam can be with him when he goes in to do the service until he comes out. And that means, afilo otan she ketuv behen, dmut pneim pnei Adam, lo ba'al moed. Even the angels who've got the face of Adam Rishon, the face of Earth, they're not allowed to be in there either.
So
how could an angel kick him in the head if an angel's not allowed to be in there
right. When
he's doing it?
Later.
That's what you say, that's not what Rabbi Abahu says.
Oh
dear. Okay, that's the challenge.
Oh,
okay, so Rabbi Abahu answers and says, "Amalah b'shar shul nichnas kedaka." That rule about no angels allowed only applies when the Kohen Gadol does it the proper way. Okay. If he does it the improper way, then the angels are allowed to go in and they can beat him up, and that's all okay. Fine. Okay, exciting stuff in Beit HaMikdash. So that's fine. If the Kohen Gadol does it the wrong way, then the angels can get him. And angels are allowed in there to watch him, and that's all fine. What happens if the Kohen Gadol does it the right way? Now, we have a story of Shimon HaTzadik. Shimon HaTzadik is a very interesting person who we know, we have very little, there are very few statements about him in the Gemara. One of the things we don't know about him is why he's called HaTzadik. Simeon the Righteous. I mean, there's the famous story of him. There's a story of him in Alexander of Macedonia that he led him into battle. The image led him into battle, or whatever. But I'm not sure whether that is the reason he's called Tzadik or not. But anyway, he did last a lot longer than those who came after him. So the Yerushalmi says, The reason I quote the Yerushalmi is because this concept of angels not allowed into the base into the Holy of Holies is brought in the Yerushalmi. It does not appear in the Bavli, as far as I know. That's why I quote the Yerushalmi. So another Yerushalmi says, Arbaim Shana Shimesh Shimon HaTzadik Et Yisrael Bekuna Gedola. For 40 years, Shimon HaTzadik was the Kohen Gadol. Ubeshana Achrona, in his final year, Amar Lehem, Beshana HaZot Ani Met, he came out and he said, I'm going to die this year. He came out from Yom Kippur, went home, and said, this is it, time to take out that life insurance policy. Amru Lo Me'echan HaTayodea. So they said, the family of people said to him, how do you know? Amar Lehem, he said to them, Kol Shana Beshana Shaiti Nechnas Lebeit HaKadosh HaKadoshim. Every year when I went into the Beit HaKadosh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur, Haya Zaken Echad Lavush Levanim, there was an old man wearing white clothes and wrapped in a white turban who would come in with me and leave with me. And this year, he went in with me, but he did not come out with me. And therefore, I understand this is the end. I'm not going to last the year. So the students asked Rabbi Abahu again, same students, the same Rabbi Abahu. But does it not say Kol Adam Lo Yeba Ol Moed Bevor Lachaper Bekodesh Ad Tzeitah Filo Tal Shkruv Be'en Demut Pneim Pnei Adam Lo Yeba Ol Moed? Angels aren't allowed in. How can a man, clearly it's not a physical man, so it must have been an angel. How is an angel allowed to go in with Shimon HaTzadik to the Holy of Holies? And you can't give your answer that he did it the wrong way, because he did it the right way, and he lasted 40 years in Shimon HaTzadik. So how can it be, if angels aren't allowed in, who was this person who went in with Shimon HaTzadik? So Amalon, Rabbi Abahu said to his students, Ma'amali Zahavabah Nash, did you think it was a man? And he means man, he means angel. It was not that. Ani Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chaya. I say it was God who went in with him.
In the form of an old man?
In the form of an old man, that was God.
Artistic.
Original,
yeah.
It was then. It was then. Now, I found that quite disturbing when I first read that, because Rambam should be having conniptions.
He doesn't have a physical shape.
He can't have a physical shape.
It's just that maybe he's talking about his perception.
Oh, good answer. That's what Micha Berger said as well. Let me read the next thought, and I'll give you an answer. I'll tell you why I don't like it. So it's a good answer. There's a similar story about a different Kohen Gadol, Ishmael Kohen Gadol, which is so famous they made it into a song, or perhaps because they made it into a song, it became famous. In source number 5, this is in the Bavli, it says, Sayyidina Ishmael ben Elisha says, Pam achad nechnasi laktir ktav lifnayv lifnim. It's hard to say that. Once I went to offer the incense in the Holy of Holies. Zara'iti, and I saw, Akatriel, Ka, Hashem, Tzvakot, I saw God, with four different titles. I think this name of Katriel appears only here and nowhere else. And the Kabbalists have a lot to say about what it is and what it isn't, and I don't understand any of that, so I'll leave it alone. Basically, he saw God. Shul Yoshev, Akisei Ram Venisa, who was sitting on his throne, his elevated throne. Va'amarli, and God said to me, Yishmael Bini, Bacheni. Yishmael, my son, give me a blessing. Which is odd. Amartila, so Yishmael, thinking quickly, says to God, Yehi ratzon mil sanecha, may it be your will, God, shichbeshu rachamecha et kascha, that your mercy should overpower your anger, ve'golu rachamecha al midotecha, and your mercy should rule over your other attributes, ve'titnahegim banecha b'midat rachamim, and you should act with your children with mercy, ve'tichanes lehem lefnim b'shurasad, and you should act with them within, beyond the letter of the law, be extra lenient with them. Ve'ne'ani li b'rosho, and so God nodded his head, kam mashmalan, and we learn from here that halacha shalotei birchat hetiot kala beinecha, that you should never treat a bracha lightly, even if it's from someone who is not an important individual compared to you. Now, that's crazy. How can he see God, and how can God shake his head if he hasn't got a head, and how can he, any of those things? Here, I would say your answer. I don't know what Rambam would say, but I could guess that Rambam would say that we can't see God. But just like each of the prophets had visions of what God looked like, the God put an idea into their head, and then the prophet made sense of that, yeah, of that concept by describing it in a physical way, mm-hmm, right? Way that they know. So when he sees him sitting on a throne, and that was his perception of some concept that he can't possibly actually see because it's a concept that doesn't exist in the physical world. I'm happy to accept an answer, Sigmund Brachot. Right, because he's saying it about, this is what he saw, and he's telling of the story. However, the Gemara Yerushalmi, I find that not a satisfactory answer, because it's not Shimon HaTzadik saying, this is what I saw. It's Rabbi Abahu, many, many years later, talking 300-400 years later, saying that it wasn't an angel, it was God. If what he meant was, it was his perception of what God would look like, then he should have said that. He should have said it wasn't an angel; it was his own perception. It was his own, or it was a dream, or it was a vision, or it was. There's many words he could have used without saying it was God. So I'm prepared to accept your argument. Micha Berger said exactly the same thing: that a person has some kind of spiritual awakening or concept, and they have to put it in words and things they understand. I get that. And at Har Sinai, everyone saw God, but they didn't see God. They saw what they thought God should be, and God looked back. But I'm not sure that you can say that in Rabbi Abahu.
I'm not sure why. I think I'm...
Why you
yeah,
can't?
Yeah, can you just explain why?
Because when the student said to Rabbi Abahu, no angels are allowed in,
yeah,
Rabbi Abahu said back, but it was God. Right. If what he meant was, it was Shimon HaTzadik drawing in his mind a vision of what God should look like, he should have said, it was a dream. It was a vision. It was some kind of whatever.
Did he really mean to say that then? That's what he meant. Was it really so? Did he really mean to say that?
He's distinguishing between an angel and God. Seems to me. I mean, okay. I accept your answer.
There's probably something bad.
I accept that could be an answer. It seems to me Rabbi Abahu could have said it in a better way, more clear way. If Rabbi Abahu, maybe put differently, and it's all going to become a little bit moot on the next page anyway, but if Rabbi Abahu held like Rambam, that God can't possibly have a body, isn't that a misleading thing to say to your students? I'm sure he didn't, because Rambam wasn't invented yet, but one of the most fundamental beliefs in Rambam's world is God cannot have a physical body. And here he is saying things that make it, that could easily mislead. Now, you're telling me God also said things that could mislead people. God wrote the Torah as if he's got a body. God talks about his outstretched hand and his mighty arm.
Because
and
he trusts that we're going to not take it literally.
God, people understand that's what it means.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to squeeze it on Archie.
Okay. No, I'm fine with it.
But I'll tell you why I'm. We'll get to the first of all later on. Let's look at source number six. Source number six. Is Bavli, quoting the Bavli, talking about Sancheriv. Right, Sancheriv is the general of the Assyrian army, and they're learning a verse in Yeshaya, which says that Sancheriv, pardon me, and his sons are going to get their comeuppance. God's going to wreak his revenge on. Let me just back up a second, because I was bothered by the Yerushalmi, and I looked everywhere for all the comments, and there's not very many comments on Yerushalmi. Nobody I saw said, by the way, this is problematic, what he meant was that.
Right.
No one, so everyone assumed it was so obvious they didn't need, not a single commentary of the half dozen commentaries that I found needed to mention this is not actually God.
So where did your question come from then?
With
you?
Yeah, my question. I looked at Ruchaim Kanievsky, who lives in Bnei Brak and is Rabbi Yosha's son-in-law and has a commentary on Yerushalmi. And he says, on this line of, he says the following words. The last line of Ruvahu, he said, Ani Omer, what is that? Ani Omer, Akash Baruch Hu Haya? So, Rav Chaim paraphrases, it says, Ani Omer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Haya, Shenitzta'er Be'enav Bidmut Malach. It was God who took the form in his eyes in the shape of an angel. So either he's saying exactly what you're saying, that Shimon HaTzadik imagined God looking like that, but really didn't. And it might mean that, in which case you've got very solid support for what you're saying. Or it might mean that God appeared in his eyes in the shape of an angel. If it means the second one, then that's equally problematic for Rambam. God can't look like an angel just like he can't look like a person. So it depends, I'm not sure how to read that, but that might be support for what you're saying.
You can if you want him to.
Can what?
Look like whatever you want him to.
No, he cannot, according to Rambam. No, he cannot, but we'll get to Rambam soon. Okay, so the Gemara in Sanhedrin talking about Sancheres, and it says the following.
I have a
quick
question.
What?
It's a thought.
Okay.
there was a long spring train.
Which led to?
It led to me thinking that, well, I've almost lost it now, it's there. The longer I try to think about it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, if it comes back later.
Okay.
because it was what you were saying, so I was like almost staring at you. And then oh, gosh.
Okay, since Rabbi Bahu in the Bavli, Rabbi Bahu is, Rabbi Bahu was the Gadol Hador in Eretz Yisrael in the third generation of Amoraim. He was a student of Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. He was the last of the major rabbis who was born in Eretz Yisrael. So he was the only one in that generation. Most of the others, Torah really had moved to Babel by then. And he was in Eretz Yisrael. He was an expert on Agadata. Wherever he used to go, he used to give a shiur on Agadata, and everyone came running to hear him, and he knew all sorts of Agadata. His halakhic statements are not so, there's not so many halakhic statements from him.
You're a lot of the historian.
No.
I don't even remember who was
what. No, I don't. I just look it up every week, every day. Try and remember.
A lot of people in here, but just quote a person, but not knowing so much background on them.
Yeah, I used to do that, and then I realized if you actually understand who they are, then it makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Rabbi Abahu said, Il male nikra katuv. If it wasn't written in the text, Iyashala Omra, it would be impossible to say such a thing. So he says, I'm saying something that's a little bit dangerous, and I can only say it because the Torah, because the Navi says it, otherwise I wouldn't be able to say it. Just see what it says in Ishaya, it's a very long, convoluted sentence. Bayom mahu yigalach Hashem betar haschira be'avrei nahar be'melech ashur et harosh v'seh raglaim v'gamet v'taken tispeh. On that day, God will shave with a borrowed razor on the other side of the river, the king of Ashur, his head and the hair of his legs, and he will cut off his beard. Okay, that's the verse. Says Rabbi Abahu, Ata kud shebrichu, God came, ve'id milei kigavra saba, and appeared to Sancheriv like an old man. Same old man as we had in the Yerushalmi praying to Shimon HaTzadik. Now, the Yad, and this story goes on for a long time. Yad Rama, for example, who is a Rishon, Yad Rama explains that of course God doesn't have a physical body. Of course God doesn't appear like a person, but God made an old man be there who was doing the will of God at that time, and therefore Rabbi Yoel describes him as God being an old man. That's fine. Rashi, though, on the Gemara, says, that if it weren't written, it would be impossible to say it. Rashi says, "Shakadosh Baruch Hu be'atma," that God Himself appeared to him. Now, you can tell me the same answer again. Of course, it wasn't God. It was some cherished vision of God. And he just happened to have the same vision of God as Shimon HaTzaddik had, because everyone who's read The Color Purple knows that God's an old man with a beard and not a young black woman. But so I read that book when it was first out. It's such an old book now. Could be.
Why do you see the same
manifestation as... I just say, both times God appeared as an old man. That's what I mean.
This isn't an exclusive thing, though, the idea of God as an old man.
It's not exclusive.
Oh,
okay. What are you saying? I have to hear.
No, it's not. It's not like these are the only two examples, therefore you set the same as a brief example, or nothing like
no.
that. Like, it's
no.
just a concept.
Right, but Rabbi Abahu both times describes God as looking as an old man.
Sorry.
God appeared to person X as an old man.
And in the case of the Kadosh Kadoshim, it couldn't have been the other idea that it was like a man just happened, an old man just happened
no,
to be there.
No, can't say that.
Because it couldn't have gone away.
Which is presumably why Rashi said
it has to be God,
God himself.
Okay. I hope it's a lot.
Yeah.
Because I'm solid, so
okay.
It might work. So going along with like this idea of perception, if Rabbi Abahu, who is the one basically defining these visions or these manifestations or whatever, is using the same imagery in both examples, then maybe he's referring to the same aspects of God that were shown in those examples. So like those the aspects of Hashem that are like an old man, whatever they may be, whether they're wise or whether they're, you know, like giving puppies out in short or like whatever they are. You know, whatever he associates with an old man or whatever we in general in life in human race, whatever we associate with old men, maybe that's what he's going for by saying old man. Maybe he doesn't actually mean like the physical imagery of an old man. Maybe he means those were the parts of Hashem that were relevant at that time. Like he could say a young boy, in which case it would be a completely different, or a young girl, whatever, a completely different aspect of Hashem that wouldn't have been relevant in these examples. It could just be that he doesn't.
Good answer. I agree with you.
It's kind of like halfway between.
I certainly agree with you. I'm sure that the Kabbalists learn a lot of stuff about this imagery, and old man must mean Atik Yomin, and the beard means something or other. And I don't mean, I'm sure that's right. If you've ever read Anonymous Mirot in English, you'll see we describe God in all sorts of different ways. He's an old man, he's a young man, he's got black hair, he's got a white beard, he's all those different forms, and they're all Kabbalistic. There were people who didn't want Anonymous Mirot said in short because they thought people would treat these Kabbalistic concepts lightly. So I totally agree with what you're saying as a concept, and whenever we see God in Tanakh appearing in a certain way, then I get that. I'm only bothered by it, I'm much less bothered by it when it's in Tanakh, or when somebody says, I saw God looking like this. I get that. When Rabbi Abba was saying what happened was even earlier before him, this is 700 years before him, saying God appeared to Sancho as an old man.
Is it because it's a second-hand description? That's really the problem.
It's because he's teaching his students how to learn the story. And it seems to me a very confusing way of teaching the story. And now you're saying it's so obvious he doesn't need to say it any other way, and I accept that. But it just seems to me that if he was really bothered that somebody might misunderstand him, he could have said it. But there are many other ways. He didn't see this.
Right.
He's not saying what he saw. He's saying how to understand it. And it just seems to me confusing. Misleading. That's
so, I don't know,
and,
I feel like
and also the old man is lovely with Shimon HaTzaddik. You can imagine the old man walking in that garden, he's going with him in and coming out with him. And but when he's coming to destroy Sancheret and shave his head, an old man is, to my absolutely ignorant concept, seems like the wrong kind of image.
Mm.
You want a guy with a barber pole outside and a fancy moustache, I don't know what, but it doesn't seem the right kind of image. That God is an old man who's going to come and destroy Sancheret. But it could be, and I'm not arguing with you, I'm just pointing out there's another statement of Rabbi Abba.
I could think of things that relate to weather.
Yeah, no, I
could play it into the character of an old man, but...
Could do. I'm not saying anything you're saying is not correct.
Yeah.
It could, well, it almost certainly is correct, and I'm probably wrong. What bothers me is that Rabbi Abba is saying things in a way that could be very misleading.
Okay.
To which you'll answer that God also says things in a way that are misleading. One is a rebuttal better than God.
Okay.
God did not say Adam Batsal made a lit up make man. Oh, no, for two gods. No, it's not. Ha ha, fooled you. I mean, I get that, but it just seems weird. So I went and looked in Arya Katzman's book, The Handbook of Jewish Thought, right? Because I was trying to find, let me ask the question a different way. Where in, even though I knew the answer already, but anyway, where in Chazal, where do we have a statement saying that God cannot have a human form?
What we just read.
Rambam says it. Before Rambam. Yeah. Before, where did Rambam get that idea from? Which Gemara does Rambam see that God can't have a form? Where's the statement? You know, in if I was writing the Gemara, I'd put rule number one: God can't have a, God exists. God is what? God can't take a physical form. That's a really important concept.
That's part of the effect of Israel,
though. No. 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 I am the Lord your God.
I think it's a trick question and it doesn't
exist. I think you're right. Well, I looked at Harry Katzman's book, and he directed me to a different Yerushalmi. He says categorically Judaism, I can't remember the right words, but he basically says even though God can do anything, he can't do something which is logically impossible, such as create another God or destroy himself or I don't know what else. And therefore God rejects the possibility that God can have a physical form. That could be the Rambam, basically. Arya Katzman says it. In the footnotes, as in Handbook of Jewish Thought, chapter 2, section 14, I think, in footnote 17, he brings the source of the Yerushalmi over here, which happens to be Rabbi Abahu again, which is very convenient, so I got excited. So tell me if this to you seems like he is categorically denying that God could ever have a physical form. There's a verse in Parshat Balak, with Bilam, one of the many blessings that God gives, that Bilam gives the Jewish people. In there it says, Lo ish kel v'chazed. God is not a man, that he should tell lies. The law, I'm supposed to say, the law, ben adam, something else, I can't remember. That's the verse. And the Gemara has two different approaches to what that verse means. Then along comes Rabbi Abahu, Amar Abahu, Im yomar lecha adam, El Ani, if a man comes and says to you, I'm God, Mechazefu, he's a liar. If he says, Ben Adam Ani, I'm a man, but by man he means I'm a big tzaddik, I'm a holy person, give me respect. Sofo lit hotspo, then eventually he'll fail because of that. If he says, Shani ole l'shamayim, I'm going to climb up to heaven, he's saying it, but it's not going to happen. So, I don't know what you think. To me, this does not seem like a categorical denial that God could ever have a physical form.
No, but I think, I don't know, is there not just simply a clash of definitions?
That
maybe, like, what we interpret right. If there's no original source for this idea, then it means that people have basically defined what it is for God to be in a visible form, okay? So, obviously, like, I don't think anyone is going to say God can completely contain himself into one visible form. Like, no one would say that. Firstly, it's impossible for us to even imagine. Secondly, like, that would go against a lot of things. But if there's no original concept, why can't we get rid of the idea that he can manifest parts of himself into a physical form? I feel like it's just simply, it could just be explained by a class of definition.
Rambam would not let you say that, though.
Right, well, Rambam, would just disagree with Rambam.
Right, that's what I'm trying to say. Okay. I agree with you. Finally.
That's not my father. Yeah. I'm going to... Okay. We'll see. I'm going to stand on to the legal steps if he gets free international calls and then we can start calls country, but he's bad boy me. I'm not picking up any calls. Anyway.
If you look back at Rambam, look back at Animami, in source number one, it says God is not physical, and nothing physical can happen to him, and he's got no ein lo shum dimyon klal. There's no kind of any image or any kind of thing. Right. Now, I know that's not Rambam's word.
I mean, not that that's a bad thing.
I'm saying that Rambam...
There's room for disagreement.
Yes.
And I think that's just what's happening, maybe.
Yes, that's what I think is going to happen. I think Rabbi Abahu is of the opinion that God, should he choose to, for whatever reason, could manifest in physical form. As well as being everywhere else and everything else, and it might be impossible, but I think that he can do it. And therefore, I would say the opposite. Not only is this not a proof that God can't have physical form, I think the fact that Rabbi was saying this is a proof that God could have a physical form if he wanted to.
Yeah.
He's saying if a man says, I'm God, now, according to Rambam, man says, I'm God, he's just delusional. According to Rabbi, he's a liar, because God wouldn't say that, but
right.
It's not... That's so I think with
but
all...
But isn't that what Rambam's saying in the first place?
It's not Rambam's saying. It's not Rambam's saying. I'll come back to Rambam. It's not Rambam's saying, definitely not. I think Rabbi Bahu is saying, at least from this quote, all he's saying is that if somebody says they're God, don't believe them. But not that God couldn't if he so chose to do that. The fact that Arya Kaplan doesn't bring any other source leads me to believe there is no other source. Furthermore, if I didn't know any better, I would say that Rabbi Bahu over here is speaking against Christianity, specifically.
Sounds like it.
Because there's three things over here. If somebody says they're God, if somebody says they're man, and if somebody says they're going up to heaven.
Half and half,
right, half and half, and the Holy Ghost as well, while you're at it. It seems clearly to me that Rabbi Bahu is attacking Christianity here. Mm-hmm. And the next thing, he's not saying God can't be physically saying, if someone says they are, then they're lying. Specifically, that person who did say they were.
When did Christianity
start? Oh, well, probably about the year zero, approximately.
Okay.
But no, it did not. That's a very good question. When did Christianity start? Really, it started with Paul.
So 30 years after Jesus died.
Yeah. That's a very good question. So we're looking for number 9.
We'll do that parallel.
And until the Council of Nicaea, it was not clear whether Jesus was God or was man. It was machlokas, and then they studied both, which was 325 or something.
We should know because we think about
it. Okay. Anyway, there's another thing, Rabbi Bahu, which also leads me to think that he's attacking Jesus and Christianity. It says in Shemot Rabbah, right? He starts off with the Ten Commandments, but he's not using it. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Am Rabbi Bahu, Mashal Lemelach Basar V'Dam, Molech. We could compare this to a human king, Yesh lo av or ach, and he might have a brother or father or brother. So God says, I'm not like, I'm a Kodesh Baruch Hu, ani eino ken, I'm not like that. And he quotes this verse now from Yeshaya, ani rishon, she'en li av, ani acharon, she'en li ach, umibaladi ein elokim, she'en li ben. What?
What's that noise?
It's an airplane. Do you have them in your country?
Not too much.
In nightmare. That's a land in your next door neighbor's garden. So Yeshaya says, I am the... Jesus says, I am the Alpha, I am the Omega. But Yeshaya says, before that, Adi Rishon V'Ani Acharon, talking about God. And Rabbi says, I am first, means I've got no father. I am last, I've got no brother, and without me there is no God, I've got no son. It seems to me that's another direct attack on Christianity. I mean, why else would you say God's not a father and a son? No one ever thought of that
until
Christians came along and said it. And so when did Christianity start? Christianity started at some point, first of all, where did Rabbi Bahu live? He lived in Caesarea, which was the seat of the Roman government.
Right.
He was well involved in the political world. He was very close to the proconsul for the Roman government. He also is quoted in other places as being an expert in Greek. He taught his daughters Greek. He taught his students Greek, which means he knew how to deal with the... He was not living in an ivory tower, but was dealing with the practical realities on the ground at the time. which means he would know about Christianity. He would know the threat of Christianity, and you know the theology of Christianity. He also lived in the time of Diocletian, the emperor Diocletian, however you say his name, who was the last... Christians were persecuted under the Romans for the first 300 years or so, until Constantine came and became Christian and converted the Roman Empire to the Holy Roman Empire and declared Christian the state religion. But 20 years before Constantine, yeah, Diocletian, that was the last time that the Christians were persecuted. Rabbi Bahu lives then in the time when the Roman Empire is deciding whether they're going to be Christian or not be Christian, and he's stating that Judaism does not allow for Christianity.
Mm.
It seems to me that he would have been able to say such a thing because Christians were being persecuted by the Romans at the time. That wasn't a dangerous statement. At that short period of history, he could have said it. 100 years later, he wouldn't have been able to say anything against Christianity because it would have been too dangerous. Certainly in Eretz Yisrael, maybe in Babel, where they're under the Persian rule and they were Zoroastrians, but in Israel, you wouldn't have been able to say that 20 or 30 years later on. He could say it then, and he's attacked Christianity. Which I suppose makes it all the more strange that he doesn't reject the possibility of God being having a physical form. Okay, over the page on the subject. Page 4.
Why
would
it make sense for him?
Jews nowadays turn to Christians and say Jesus can't be God because God can't have a physical form.
Well, that's because they're religious.
Okay. Okay.
That means we have a whole life.
Okay, fair enough.
God, whatever.
Fair enough.
It doesn't make sense to him. I mean, in theory, I have a big thing. It would make sense to him to come out and say, you know, everything you're saying is wrong, right? This whole concept doesn't make sense. But, like, just to go against your own concept.
No, you're right.
Basic argument.
Well, that's what I mean. He must actually believe this concept.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Otherwise,
he does believe that if he's speaking at a time when there's when he's trying to be against Christianity, if he didn't believe that God had a physical form, he could have very easily said, don't get confused,
right,
God's not
right.
Physical, but this man was the manifestation. That, just coming back to the first point, that when he said God, it was misleading at a time when being misleading was not a clever thing to do. So I think he actually believed it as he said it.
Yeah.
I haven't rejected what you said originally, but it just doesn't feel like that to me. Source number 10 is not really connected at all, but I just want to show that Rabbi Abahu was a important person who was making social political decisions that would have long impact. But he says that God can't have a physical body, he said that God can't have a father and a brother, and that God can't, if someone says they're God, they're not. In other words, he rejected Christianity saying, when Jews are not Christians, we can't believe the same things you guys believe. I'm not sure how wide this bit was, probably, but I think it was a fairly broad gap, but he certainly made sure there was no room for overlap. You couldn't get confused as to whether you're a Christian or a Jew. He also put the final nail in the coffin of the Samaritans. Samaritans are very interesting people. They were brought in by Sancherib when the 10 tribes were exiled from Israel. There was a big empty space. And Sancherib or Nebuchadnezzar practiced moving populations around to different countries so that they wouldn't be less likely to rebel against the empire, and also soon be big empty spaces. So they brought in these people and stuck them in the Shomron, so they became called the Shomronim, which in English became the Samaritans, Samaria. And these poor old people showed up, got plonked down in the middle of the Shomron, and they were doing their own whatever they were doing. And then they started getting eaten by lions. And that wasn't very much fun, being eaten by lions. So they thought about it, and they decided they should become Jewish, because then the lions wouldn't eat them anymore, because living in Israel, it's a Jewish country. They all converted to become Jewish, and the lions stopped eating them. Great. So that was wonderful, and they were...
Are these guys where the whole concept of Samaritans?
Yes, the good Samaritan. The Samaritans is from a parable of Jesus.
Right.
Who saw a good Samaritan, even though the Samaritans were downtrodden people. But in the parable of the Samaritan is showing the rabbis are awful and nasty and don't care about poor people, and the Samaritan looked after this poor downtrodden person when all the religious rabbis ignored him and didn't care about him.
Mm.
So it's quite an anti-Pharisaic parable. But yes, it's the same concept. So they became Jewish, but becoming Jewish so you don't get eaten by a lion is not really a very good... If you go to the basis and say, I want to be Jewish so I'm eaten by a lion, I'll say, we think it's an ulterior motive, not convinced by that motivation. So the rabbis, throughout the Mishnaic period, were a bit ambivalent as to whether these people were really Jewish or not really Jewish. There's some Mishnahites that assume they are, some Mishnahites are a bit skeptical. At some point, they found they're actually worshipping idols as well. So they weren't very happy, and they kind of ruled out... They said, we can't really trust to be Jewish. It was a gradual process. The final stage of them being absolutely considered idolaters was Rabbi Abba Pass condemned. And the so again, it's not just Christianity at all, but it just shows Rabbi Abba was aware of what was going on and not afraid to make serious decisions that have implications on groups of people. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Yosef, Shadri Rabbi Abba La Turi Chamra Mibay Kutai. Rabbi Abba sent Rabbi Yitzchak bar Yosef to bring wine from the Kutians, in other words, for Shomronim. And of course, you can't buy wine from somebody who's an Obed Avodah Zarah. So you've got to check whether they're from Jews or not. Ashkecheh hu Saba. So Rabbi Yitzchak saw an old man, another old man, but this one wasn't God. Tosfot here is not sure whether it's Eliyahu HaNavi or not. He says it probably isn't Eliyahu HaNavi, although it might be.
Why would it?
Well, it would make sense if it was Eliyahu HaNavi. That would be great. He says, what Tosfot says is you can't assume that because it says Hahu Saba, it always means Eliyahu, because there's another case in Gemara Shabbat where Hahu Saba clearly does not mean Eliyahu HaNavi. But anyway. Amalei, late kan shomrei Torah. This old man said to Rabbi Yitzchak, don't buy your wine here, no one here keeps the Torah. Halach Rabbi Yitzchak is siper devarim lifnei Rabbi Bahu. So Rabbi Yitzchak went and told Rabbi Bahu that these shomronim are not good. Halach Rabbi Bahu was siper devarim lifnei Rabbi Ami Rabbi Asi. Rabbi Bahu went to his students, Rabbi Ami Rabbi Asi, who were immigrants from Babylon. He told them this over. Velo zazu misham ad she asum ovdei kachavim gemurin. And they paskin the halacha that from now on the shomronim have the halachic status of complete of idolaters, and not of Jews, and not even of an in-between category of something else. So, well, Rabbi Bar was a powerful person. This was possibly, according to Gretz, this is the last act of the Sanhedrin, the last rabbinic rule that applied, that was binding on everybody. So it seems to me that Rabbi Abahu is not afraid to say that God could appear in a body, and even though he rejects Christianity, he does not necessarily reject the fact that God, if he wanted, could take a physical body. There is a fundamental machlokas, I guess amongst philosophers, but also amongst medieval rabbis, as to whether God is bound by the laws of logic or not.
Logic.
Does God have to obey the laws of logic?
Why
would he? Why wouldn't he? When we say, for example, God is omnipotent, God can do anything, does that mean he can do something that's logically impossible?
Yeah. Creating a stone that's too heavy for him to lift
up. Can God make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift up?
I read something about the Jews, recently this weekend, we were discussing it. And I think it's also said, I've already stopped him again, oh my God. No, it said, I know this, we were talking about, yes, okay. But I'm really lost. Okay. We were talking about how God, right, okay, I'm there. So God could never do anything that disobeys our logic, because God makes the logic for us to understand his universe and to give us the trademark of his universe. Therefore, wouldn't it be incredible if God did do something which was outside of that universe? Because why would he do that? Because then he would be destroying his own trademark.
What if we never saw it?
If we never saw what?
That's a good question. If you assume that this is really Descartes' problem as well, then Descartes says, I can prove logically that I exist, but who says that my logic works? Maybe logic doesn't make sense. So Descartes says, since I believe in God, and God must use logic, therefore it must be true. If it makes sense logically, it must be true. So there's a whole school of thought, which I think nowadays, apart from the cure of rabbis, I think that's probably the main dominant, people who really think about this question, probably the dominant thing is that God must obey the laws of logic. That God is bound by the laws of logic. It's something that's illogical.
But only within the realm of his relationship with us.
Okay, fine. When we talk about whatever God means in terms of the relationship with us, if we were to say God can't do something that's illogical, that does not limit, that does not remove his omnipotence.
Not can't, though. I think can't is the word that I'm thinking of. That's what
God chooses to follow the laws of logic, and by doing so, that does not in any way mitigate his omnipotence.
Okay.
But anything that he does always has that trademark, therefore it follows logic. So technically God could never, ever go far away enough from that logic.
I don't think God's been sort of over like that. I think if he, in another, like, if it was something that was irrelevant to his relationship with us, which is like a whole other discussion whether there is anything that's irrelevant to the relationship, but still, whatever. Let's say someone thinks that there is. He can do what he wants. This is another world that's just empty, or another, like, area of being that's completely empty and irrelevant to his relationship with us. He can do anything. It doesn't have to follow.
But anything becomes logic.
No, it's irrelevant to his relationship.
Let's limit our discussion to God as revealed in this world. Does that make you happier? God, as he chooses to reveal himself in this world.
It's semantics.
No, it's not semantics, but it's getting into post-Arizal stuff, and I want to talk about Rishonim, so I don't want to get into...
Okay.
I absolutely agree with you. When we're talking about God outside of the universe, we can't say anything, we don't know anything at all about him.
Mm-hmm.
But God as revealed in this world,
right,
which is shorthand for God.
Okay.
Right. Then God must follow the laws of logic, and in so doing, that's not called limiting himself or being not omnipotent. God can do anything which is logically possible.
Can I also just point out that he's constantly changing the laws of logic? Isn't that what science is essentially? Like, the more we learn about science, the more we learn that things that we thought were illogical are actually, you know, they're bending, they're growing even.
I'm not sure that the laws of logic change though.
I mean, the more you learn about
things that we thought were true, I'm not sure.
The discovery of things that already exist,
I'm not sure the logic.
I think that is also logic. If you look at like science now, for science 100 years ago, like, or even, yeah, whatever.
I'm talking about like quantum stuff.
I'm thinking specifically of medicine or something. Something that someone thought was so logical, you put leeches on someone to suck out the bad and funny. But for them, that was logical. But now we know that actually that doesn't really mean
that. So I don't mean that kind of word, use the word logical though.
That was
sensible, that was the correct treatment. Logic would mean that something... logic does fall apart in a sense in the world of quantum, but logic still says... quantum doesn't behave logically, but logic still says it's logic. Logic means that I'm not a philosopher, whatever the rules of logic are, and it could be the rules of logic change.
I think that's not something changing, but
I don't think science changed the laws of logic.
I think science is an example of how we see the laws of logic changing.
That's going to be too complicated for me, so I'm going to pretend that logic exists. Point is, there is a school of Rishonim, starting certainly with Rav Sadia Gaon, probably with Philo even earlier, certainly Rav Sadia Gaon, Rambam, and all of the philosophical Rishonim held that God follows the laws of logic, and something which is illogical is not limiting God. The fact that God can't make a rock bigger than he can lift is not a limitation of God. And therefore, logic dictates that God can't take a physical form, because then God would be limiting himself physically. Even if he says, the Rambam's concept of God, you can't have God everywhere and in a physical form. God can't take a physical form in the Rambam system, understanding of God and his system's logic. Just have to believe me on that.
I understand that, I just don't agree with it.
Right. There is another school of thought.
There's another school of thought
which says God can do anything he wants, and who are we to say God's got to follow our laws of logic? Logic is a tool that we use to make sense of the world, but God is beyond that, and God can do things that are illogical and impossible and don't make any sense to us, because he's God, and who are we to say God can or can't do something like that? And therefore, that's stronger, if the Torah says God's hand, then the Torah wants us to think God has a hand. Whatever that may be or whatever that may mean, the Torah is telling that. How can I say, but that doesn't make sense to me logically, and therefore I've got to make it mean something else? Right? No, the Torah says this, that's what God wants me to believe. The rabbis say this, that's what I'm supposed to believe, and that's my tradition, that's my religion, and the fact that philosophers think something different is none of my business. So God absolutely can do things that are completely illogical because he's God. And if you say he can't, then you're limiting God's omnipotence. And therefore, there exists at least one Rishon who says that Rav Sadia's version of God, who is bound by the laws of logic, which is also Rambam's version of God, that is heretical. because how can you say God can't do something?
Right, God can't take a physical form.
Yeah, so there are at least two schools of thought. There may be others in between, but there are at least two schools of thought. Rambam's view has become the accepted view in Judaism today. I think most Jewish people would say God cannot have a physical body. Although I think Kabbalists are skating on thin ice, in a sense. A lot of spheres is about God having different kind of physical. So anyway, I'm running out of time, but what is Rambam's thought? What is Rambam's thought that the God can't have a physical form? Where he wrote 13 principles in his introduction to Chelek, source number 11 here, I'll just very quickly, he says that God is incorporeal. Right, he can't have any of the physical things, blah, 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 blah. And the only source from Chazal he brings is a quote from the Gemara Chagiga, which is slightly different than our Gemara, which says, Ein lemala lo yeshiva lo amida, lo orif lo ipui. That upstairs in heaven there is no sitting and no standing and no turning back of the neck and no exhaustion. Right? So Rambam understands the word orif, turning away, to be some kind of physical separation, and therefore he understands that through statement, saying that God can't have any kind of physicality. And then he brings also Psukim. But even Rambam admits there are far more verses that say God does have a body than verses that say God doesn't have a body. So you really can't, and Rambam says any verse that says God has a body has to be understood allegorically or metaphorically or some other way, and clearly does not mean that. Once you said that, you can't bring a verse in support of your position that God doesn't have a body either, because who says that? So the only source from the rabbis that he brings is this Gemara Chagiga, which I also put in source number 12, the same. The sort of, as we have in our Gemara, it's talking about Acher, and I'm getting faster and faster from my time, but Acher is Elisha ben Avuya, one of the four rabbis who went into the Parades with Rabbi Akiva.
You did this before, right?
And he became a heretic. Why did he become a heretic? It says that he saw Metatron, and Metatron was sitting down. Now, I don't know exactly who or what Metatron is, but he's not God. But Acher thought he was God. And he saw him sitting down, and Acher says, Gemira. Yes, he's a transformer. Gemira, we have a tradition to the Mala Loi Havi Loi Shiva Loi Tacharut Loi Oref Loi Ipui, and therefore Shem Chasom Sham Bed Rishiyohem. So then he thought, maybe there's two gods, because I see this thing is sitting down, and there's God as well, so there must be. I always understood that Gemara is talking about the angels can't sit down, not talking about God. And whereas Rambam is going to say this is what God can't do. So I'm sure Rambam's right, because he's always right, but I'm not convinced it's the only way of learning it. If you look in Moreh Nevuchim, the whole first section of Moreh Nevuchim is trying to explain how every time it says something in the Torah that looks like God's way, it doesn't mean God's way, it means something else entirely. When it says God spoke to Moshe, it doesn't mean spoke, because that's a physical thing. When it says God did, it doesn't, all those things. So he in book 1, section 36, he says, can you let people off the hook if they believe God has a physical body, just because they never learnt, they didn't know any better. They were just a bit silly. In fact, Rambam says, why does the Torah use physical terminology which could be misleading if it's clearly utter to think such a thing? The answer is... People don't know any better. If you would say that God has no physicality, you might think there's no God. People can't cope with God without any physicality. Therefore, the Torah wrote in a way that looked as if it was physical. Rambam seems to say, though, nowadays we're more sophisticated than that, and we can cope with an abstract concept of God is not physical. And therefore, he wants to say, you should, even if they can't understand it, you've got to tell even women and children and foolish people, you've got to tell them the tradition is God has no physicality, regardless of that. So he says, if you start saying that people who believe in God, that people who believe that God has a body, if you say, well, they didn't know any better, then you say the same thing about people who worship idols as well. And he says, this is a bad translation, but anyway. There is no excuse whatever for those who, being unable to think for themselves, do not accept the doctrine of the incorporeality of God from the true philosophers. I do not consider these men as infidels who are unable to prove the incorporeality, but I hold those to be so who do not believe it. In other words, Rambam says the source, didn't get that thing yet. The source for Rambam is Aristotle. Aristotle shows that God can't have a physical body. Rambam says, I don't expect everyone to be able to understand Aristotle or to be able to prove it, but they have to believe it. If they don't believe it, then they're heretics. Yeah. That's the real source of Rambam. Not any. The reason Rambam finds sources in Chazal that say that is because he believes, based on Aristotle's concept of God, that it's impossible for God to have a physical body. In Mishnah Torah, and I'll just... Mishnah Rambam says in 13, there are five... He's listing the people who have no portion in the world to come. They're cut off and destroyed. And they're judged for their wickedness and their sin. Forever and ever and ever and ever. Right? And there's five different categories. Oh, sorry, there are more than five. There's several different categories. One of those categories is called minim, which this translation put infidels. And he says, Chamisha hein anikreim minim. There are five categories of people who are called min. Ha'omer she'en sham elokah. Someone says there is no God. Okay. Ve'en alam manhig. And the world has no leader, no director. That's one. Ha'omer she'esh sham manhig. Aval hem shnayim oyoter. Someone says there is a God, but there's more than one God. They're out. And number three. Ha'omer she'esh sham ribon echad. Ela shu guf o bal tmuna. Somebody who says there is one God, but he's physical, he has some kind of image, that person is going to burn in hell forever and ever and ever. And he goes on further, the Rav there argues with Rambam and says, that's a bit rough, if somebody doesn't know any better and they just happen to believe the words of the Tanakh, or they believe the Agadata, why should they burn in hell for that? But fundamentally, Rav agrees with Rambam. So it seems to me that when he says that, Rambam is in effect retroactively sentencing Rabbi Abahu to burn in hell forever. Which is ironic, because the Yerushalmi tells us about what kind of Gan Eden Rabbi Abahu got in source number 14. Kishemet Rabbi Abahu, when Rabbi Abahu died, Heru lo et chelko hamizuman lo ba'olam haba. They showed him his portion in the world to come. The viewers now Yud Gimun Nare Afar Simon, they passed from 13 rivers of persimmon oil, which is very fragrant. Kishashal lemi kol eile, so Rabbi Abahu said, what's all that about? They said to him, "Kol elu b'shvil Rabbi Abahu." This is all for Rabbi Abahu. Hitpalev amer, he was amazed, and he said, "Ha'amnam kol elu b'shvili him? Is it really all for me? Ani amati l'rek yegati. I thought I was doing it all for nothing. I wasn't going to get any reward at all, and now I see I get a reward." So we have here clearly somebody who seems to be in Rambam's category of minim does get a lovely olam haba, even though Rambam has passed him that he won't. So we have to say that the rules changed, that Rambam was changing the rules.
It's all worth it in the end, as long as you do it right.
As long as you do it right, according to whichever right it has to be. So, okay.
You can't really know, okay.
That ends.
You can't really know something.